Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 20% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy. Do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show once again. And as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg. With me in the studio this week is Kayla Whaley, a writer living outside Atlanta with a focus on disability, sexuality, and the body. Her work has appeared at Catapult, The Toast, Michigan Quarterly Review, and The Establishment. She's getting her MFA at the University of Tampa. Kayla, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited for you to be here, and it's just putting me back in mind of the last time that I saw you
in one of the best days of my life
outside of Atlanta. I'm so glad. It was not one of the best days of my life, in as much as later I ended up becoming very, very ill.
Oh.
But I did enjoy hanging out with you at that Marriott Starbucks.
Yes, and also you taught me so much about King Henry's wives, all of them.
I mean, those are the two things I'm good at, is getting unexpectedly ill and talking about the most well-known wives in English history.
It was easily the best extemporaneous lecture I've ever experienced.
I will take that and I will run with it. And let's just use that energy to bear on all of our questions today. I should have tried to find questions that put me in mind of the wives of Henry VIII. But I didn't. I didn't. I do feel like I got to do a good cross section of professional problems, friendship problems, relationship problems, and some that actually combine all of the above, which I'm kind of jazzed about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Would you actually be so good as to read the first letter?
Sure. I would love to. All right. The first letter is just called Too Close for Comfort. One of my very closest friends, more like family, has initiated a calculated incursion on my workplace. She applies for every job that comes up and talks about how I need to get her a job. Most recently, she applied for one that would be in my group, in the office next door. She hasn't asked me if this is okay. I don't feel like I can tell her not to apply, but although I wish her the best, I hope she doesn't find a job here. I have no control over hiring, so there is nothing I can do. I feel terrible for feeling this way. This job has been a godsend after several very rough years, and I feel like all the good is being sucked away.
So I was actually a little surprised by this letter because I was sort of reading it waiting for the problem.
Because
It was sort of like a really good friend of mine wants to work at my company and that's a terrible reason because I love her, but she's really bad at completing projects or something. But it's just sort of taken for granted that this is a terrible idea.
Yeah. I read it and I feel like it's just a question of boundaries. It feels like the letter writer wants to keep their friends and their work fairly separate, which I think is a pretty common impulse. But yeah, it definitely, there's no reason beyond I don't want her here to not want her here, which is fine.
Sure. And I mean, I can certainly imagine any number of reasons why a person would not want a very close friend, almost like a family member, to work with them. I can furnish a couple of reasons why.
Yeah.
But sometimes I feel like my job is just telling people to talk to each other. But that's slightly simplistic and slightly reductive. But do you think the letter writer's current strategy of not saying anything and hoping that nothing happens is ultimately going to be the best one? Or do you think that there are other options available to them?
It is decidedly not the option I would recommend. But it feels like this is a communication issue because she hasn't told the friend that she doesn't want her there. And I realize that would be a really uncomfortable conversation to have with even a best friend, to say, hey, I love you. You're one of the closest people in my life. Don't come into this space with me that you clearly want to be in, if maybe it's just because you want to be near me and you think it'd be fun to work together, or maybe it's a really appealing job for this other person and it would be a great opportunity professionally for them. We don't really know what the friend's motivation is for wanting a job at this workplace so badly. But yeah, I think that the phrase a calculated incursion is really interesting, because that suggests to me that a level of like almost perceived aggression, if that makes any sense, on the letter writer's part about her friend's motivation. And yeah, I think that boundaries is the key word here, like just setting your own boundaries and having that potentially uncomfortable conversation to save yourself some heartache in the future. Because if your friend does get the job, that's going to be an even more difficult conversation to have. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And certainly the calculated incursion is like, there's clearly something going on with this friendship dynamic. Either you have felt like this person has a history of stepping on your boundaries, or you feel like they just want to work together because she just wants to like spend 24 hours a day with you. I don't know what it is. But there are, I think, a couple of options available to the letter writer. So there's the lowest impact one, which is like lowest conflict, lowest amount of truth telling, sort of minimum involvement, which is to say to your friend, hey, I have absolutely no control over hiring.
Right.
Which at least would put a stop to, you know, hey, you need to get me this job, where you can just say like, hey, you know, I know you're really excited about this, but like, I just want you to have a realistic expectation of what my ability to help you is, which is basically nothing.
Yeah.
I have no input. I am not consulted on this. This is not my team. No one will be soliciting my feedback. And so if, you know, again, if she does have a history of stepping all over your boundaries, or if for whatever reason you're just not feeling like being super honest with her today, that is an option, right? Another option is to say, hey, I would love to talk to you about this recent intense enthusiasm for working at my company.
That's a nice alternative calculated incursion.
Yeah, I would not use that phrase. I would save that phrase for if the fight gets really bad.
Yeah.
But to just kind of say like, hey, we haven't really talked about this because you've been so enthusiastic. I'm actually not as thrilled as you are. And it's not that I don't love you, and it's not that I don't want you to have the kind of job you really want to have. I just, you know, and I don't know what the reasons are. Maybe it's just literally like the idea of working in such close proximity with someone I consider a family member feels really overwhelming to me. And that's a perfectly legitimate reason.
Yeah.
But that's the other thing, too, is like, I genuinely don't know, like, maybe this close family friend, like, this is her dream job. You do say that she applies for every job that comes up. But I just like, maybe this is her dream company, you know, maybe you work for like some wonderful company that she's been dying to work for a really long time, in which case it's not so much a calculated incursion as it is like, you work for a good company.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that is another definite important conversation, piece of the conversation that they need to have, is what is the friend's motivation? Like, because I feel like that could affect the letter writer's approach and feelings on the matter. I mean, it might not change their feelings. They might still say, hey, I still don't feel comfortable with you, you know, trying this level to get into my workplace. But it is something to keep in mind.
Yeah. And I think that the other thing that'll be helpful is to remember the things you can control and the things you can't control. So one thing you can't control is whether or not she applies to work at your company. Another thing you can't control is whether or not she gets a job there. Things that you can control are whether or not you share some of these feelings of trepidation with her, and whether or not you set limits with her if she ever does get the job. Because part of the fear right now, I think, is if she gets the job here, I will continue my strategy of never saying anything when she gets really enthusiastic about something that I don't like. And then I will lose the thing about my work life that I enjoy because it will be taken up by her.
Which is just a breeding ground for bitterness and like resentment, honestly.
Yeah. So part of this is like, you say she's been applying for a ton of jobs and she hasn't gotten anywhere with it. So I think some of what you can do is reset expectations, which is like, it does not seem like the company is super interested in hiring her. You don't say she's gotten even one interview or any sort of like encouragement. So some of what you're assuming, I think, is maybe speculation. So you can hopefully let some of that go. Just because she keeps applying does not mean she's eventually going to get a job. It's not like rolling dice over and over again where eventually you're going to roll a seven. If she's not qualified, she's not qualified. But yeah, the other thing is that if she does get the job, like if absolute worst comes to absolute worst and she gets a job in the office next door, even though she is a close friend of yours, you could absolutely still set boundaries. And you have the kind of fabulous excuse of I'm at work. So like, yep. If she wants to stop by your office all the time, or if she wants to constantly distract you, you can say things like, I need to get back to work now. I'm not available to talk right now. Thanks for this, but I have to go finish this project. Like, there's a lot of things that you can do. If the worst happened.
Yeah, I completely agree. I really, really feel like boundaries, again, I'm repeating myself, but that just was glaring to me in this letter, was like, I feel like they probably have not ever had that conversation of like, here is my limit and I need you not to cross it, because clearly the letter writer is not comfortable having that conversation, which makes sense. It's a hard one to have, but yeah, worst comes to worst, it's going to need to happen.
Right. And sometimes that's what people mean when they say that they have a close friend who is like family. Part of what that means is, so we don't talk about things that are disagreeable. Or we do, and we talk about it once and then never again because it goes very, very badly. So yeah, the conversation that you should be having with this friend is not necessarily don't apply, but it either needs to be resetting her expectations and saying, hey, I cannot help you get this job, so, you know, don't keep asking. Or if you're willing to push a little bit to say like, hey, not only can I not help you get this job, I actually have some reservations about it. I really want you to get the kind of job that means a lot to you, but I like keeping my professional, my personal life really separate. And even if you did get the job, I would not want to be like spending a lot of best friend hangout time around the office. And that might surprise your friend. She might not know that. She might be a little hurt, and that's okay. And you can, you know, reassure her. It does not mean I don't love you. It's also not something she could never get over. This could be valuable information for her.
It could. And I think that there's a way to frame that conversation too, if you do end up having it, where you are making it about both of your well-beings. Like, you don't want to present yourself as, hey, I don't want you around me, full stop. Like, talk to her, see why is she so interested in working with you? Because if it is, I just really want to work with this company, well, again, that's something to consider. If it's like, oh, I just really want to be around somebody I'm familiar with in a new work environment, that's a conversation you could have about, like, I don't know, coping mechanisms for her, or like in looking for a different job, or, hey, what if we, you know, change something about how much time we spend together outside of work? Would that like be exciting? Like, would you want to do that? Stuff like that. So I think if you frame it as, I want what's best for both of us and for our relationship, that's going to go a long way to facilitating that conversation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, remember that your problem right now is not my friend just got hired at my office. Your problem right now is my friend is constantly bringing this up to me and is asking me to get a job and I feel terrible. And you can do something about that right now. Like, you actually can say to her the truth, which is, I have no input over this. We need to drop this. So this is something you can actually address. The rest is all future-based stuff. You don't know what's going to happen. I can certainly relate to the idea of something bad might happen in the future. So the best response I can have to it is to constantly imagine it and react as if it were happening right now in real time. That's actually not a useful strategy. It actually does not get you anywhere.
Yeah.
And good luck. I hope you do not have to work with a family friend or / best friend. All right, so our next letter is about whether or not to call it quits on a relationship that's kind of already over. Which, you know, spoiler alert, well, my answer is probably going to be. But the subject is, when do I quit long-term love? Dear Prudence, how do you know when you're kidding yourself? I've been with my partner for 5.5 years. We lived together for 2 years, moving in together after only 6 months because I needed to escape my parents. And then 3 years ago, I moved away to go to university. I had originally given up on going to university, but with my partner's support, I made that move and became a mature student. I love them. I'm very in love with them. The problem is we both have severe health problems that prevent us from being able to easily and routinely communicate. These health problems probably aren't ever going to go away. I love them with all of my heart, but we still go more than a week without so much as a message, and months without talking on the phone. This is something that we've had serious talks about repeatedly, and we've both committed to doing better, but each time we quickly lapse back into the same problems. I feel like my partner expects me to move back to my home city and is waiting it out, but I'm increasingly sure that I won't move back. We've sort of talked about this, but cannot come to any conclusion because we really do, truly, and intensely still love one another. I spend most of my life feeling single and lonely, which is ridiculous. I'm in a relationship. I'm tired of bringing this up, and neither of us managed to change things, but the thought of breaking up seems untenable. Can you help me unstick myself, or at least suggest new ways of tackling this repeated conversation?
This one is so just sad. It just makes me so sad for both of them.
Mm-hmm. I do have one thought, which is something that they do not seem to have discussed yet as an option, which is not to say that this will be the thing that fixes everything. But they say, like, are there new ways of tackling this conversation? I think one is, has your partner considered moving to where you are?
That was my first thought as well.
Oh, two minds with but a single thought, two hearts that beat as one.
Because you're right, it's nowhere in here. We don't know what the partner's living situation is like. I mean, it's very possible that that's just not feasible for whatever reason. They might have a job, they might have other family in the same area, whatever. But it is something to consider and would presumably make things better, considering that seems like the only option you guys can agree would make things better is living in the same place again. And since the letter writer does not want to move back, which is a totally legitimate thing to think and to say, then that could be another option.
Yeah. And I think, too, because again, I don't know, maybe these like health problems would be such that moving would be incredibly difficult for the partner.
Yeah.
There's any number of factors that might make
Lord knows I relate to that.
Right. But I do think, you know, the key here is the sentence, I feel like my partner expects me to move back to my home city and is waiting it out, but I am increasingly sure I won't move back. We've sort of talked about this, but can't come to any conclusion because we really love each other. And that suggests to me that you guys haven't really talked about it. You've maybe both kind of lobbed impressions at one another and then kind of gotten scared because it's like, oh, if we really acknowledge this, we might feel like we have to break up and I love them. So let's walk it back.
Yep, that was exactly the impression I got, especially considering the strength of the language used elsewhere about other conversations they've had. Like the letter writer says, it's something we've had serious talks about in terms of the communication levels repeatedly. We've both committed to doing better. So like they use really strong verbiage elsewhere. But when we get to that part about moving, it's we've sort of talked about it and can't come to a conclusion. So
right,
that part feels a little bit, like you said, a little walking it back.
Which I get, because there's a profound fear here. Like, they're very, very in love, and they really want to stay together.
Yep. And they've been together for 5.5 years and have been apart for the past 3. So, you know, it's they've done the long-distance thing, and it just sounds like it's just – it's become more and more difficult to maintain.
Yeah.
And now it feels like it's at a breaking point.
Yeah. So I do think, again, you know – the possibility of your partner moving out to be with you. But mostly, I think the next thing in front of you is having that conversation of, hey, and you know, preface it with like, here's what I'm really scared about. Like, I'm scared to discuss this because I don't know what's going to happen if we talk honestly about this. And I'm really afraid to lose this relationship. Like, acknowledge the fear before you start talking, because otherwise it'll just be at the back of your mind looming over everything else, and say, I think I've gotten the impression from you whenever we've talked about the future that you think I will move back after I graduate. And that makes me really anxious because I don't want to. I don't want to break up. I want to be with you. But I also really don't want to move back to my hometown.
I think the other line that really stuck out to me here was, I spend my life feeling single and lonely, which is ridiculous. Like, that's just devastating to me to be in such a loving long-term relationship. But the circumstances of your distance between each other, your lack of communication, and the reasons behind it, which are not easy to overcome clearly, is you end up feeling single and lonely even though you're in this committed relationship. So clearly something's got to give.
Right. So, you know, you look at what are the things that you kind of can't change. One of them, it sounds like, is how much you guys communicate.
Yeah.
You've talked about it. You've both tried. It doesn't sound like it's happening as a result of indifference or getting distracted. It sounds like there's just some physical limitations that really can't budge.
Yep. The logistics of it don't sound like they're going to change anytime soon. And I think, recognizing that, and which it sounds like the letter writer at least has talked about how, you know, this happens. We've had this conversation a lot. It never changes. It's not because we don't want to. We just can't. So then, it's time to talk about, well, what comes after that? Like, what can we change then?
Right. And so one of those things might be the possibility of your partner moving out to be with you, which, you know, frankly, like if they once they realize that you're not going to move back and that that would be kind of the only option, they might be like, oh, well, shoot, I'd be willing to do that. Or they might say, no, I'm absolutely not willing to do it. And you guys would at least have enough information to make a decision. Yeah. Or you guys may decide to, you know, break up, which sounds horrible and awful, but you also say that you feel single and lonely a lot of the time, which is painful in itself. And I, you know, I don't want another 5 years of this for you. Yeah. And I don't think you would want another 5 years of this.
And I don't think your partner would want you to have another 5 years of this either. And I can't imagine that they're doing well with this situation either, from what you've said.
Yeah, I think have that honest conversation where you really clarify what you're not willing to do, and stress your commitment to your partner and ask, you know, what other options do you think we have? And if you get the chance, let us know how that conversation goes, because I'm really curious to hear what it's like if you don't sort of have it, but really have it. And good luck. You know, that's painful. I'm sorry. I wish there was something that I could say that would just fix it.
I know. It's just painful all around, especially because so much of it is like out of their control.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's always great when somebody's problem is like, you know, I'm trying to think of a great example and it's just not coming to me. But yeah, just something where it's like, oh, just do this one thing and your problem goes away. And it's like, yeah, you know, that's not the case here. And it's kind of, I think, throws into relief sometimes the limits of advice, which usually just boils down to something like be honest with yourself and be honest with somebody else.
Right. Which, yeah, much easier said than done. But sometimes it helps to have someone, you know, like you, like say, hey, here's what you should do. Talk. Use your words, children. And it helps. So
that's great. And then like 6 months later, I realize, oh, I was talking to myself. I should do this.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 nine-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
All right. Will you take our last letter?
I will. This one's a doozy.
Yeah.
All right. Subject line, how to help a depressed/anxious friend. Dear Prudence, my best friend of 20 years recently developed paralyzing anxiety followed by depression. She was always a bit of a worrier, but she also had 3 young kids, 2 dogs, and is a stay-at-home mom, so that worrying made sense to me. She's 40 years old and has no prior history of mental illness. Recently, her father, with whom she has a strained relationship, became ill. She agreed to become his power of attorney, and this is when it all went awry. I was able to direct her and provide many contacts and colleagues to walk her through the process, so he's now being cared for in a great home. Still, for whatever reason, this has sent my friend over the edge. This all happened around Christmas time, and since then she's been barraging me daily with anxious texts. She gets anxious over things that are meaningless to most, but they are always associated with her father. She will text me about how to address an envelope, how to send certified mail, how to sign a document, things she's done millions of times before. I will give her an answer, but then she'll question that answer, and this goes on for hours and days. She won't make decisions. If she feels she screws something up, she determines that means she's worthless. She's in counseling and on medication, but she continues to drink alcohol every day despite being told it can affect the medication. She's checked out of the kids' lives entirely, and her husband has had it up to here with her. I truly can't imagine how it must be to live with her in this state. I told her to resign and not help her dad, but she won't. I've been very good about answering all of her texts no matter what I'm doing, but it's starting to grow old and get irritating. I have a fiancé, and I work 60 hours a week. When I try to discuss my life with her or even joke with her, there's no response. It's like she didn't even read that part or listen. She wants immediate responses when I'm working, and everything is an emergency to her. I'm at my wit's end here. I want to help her, but I don't know how much more abject panic I can take. Help.
Oh, man. Yeah, this sounds incredibly distressing.
So distressing.
Feel for you both. Yeah.
On lots of levels.
It's hard for the kids. It's hard for your friend. It's hard for you, you know.
Yeah, there's nobody in this situation having a good time.
Yeah, no one's like, man, I'm getting away with all the best stuff. This is really working out for me.
No. Oh, Yeah, I had to like take a breath after I read this one because I was like, gosh, that's a lot. That's just a lot for everybody to handle.
Yeah. What do you feel like is the best strategy for the letter writer?
I honestly can't decide. Like,
okay.
So part of me wants to say that, I mean, the letter writers, your health and your mental well-being and your like exhaustion levels or whatever, those are worthy and important to consider too. Like, you have to look after yourself. Self-care is important. And if, you know, it sounds like you are sort of bearing the brunt of the support role here. It sounds like her husband has sort of abdicated that role a little bit. And it doesn't sound, you don't mention anybody else in a support network really besides her therapist, which, you know, obviously should be the crux of her support network. But so like on one hand, I'm like, you know, I get that that can be very overwhelming and it's okay if you have to set some boundaries. And if this is, you know, sort of interfering with your own life and your own well-being, then that's something to consider. But at the same time, the phrasing of it's getting old and irritating, I don't know. That makes me think that maybe it's not an issue of boundaries and it's not an issue of like you, the letter writer, are unable to do the things that she's asking you to do to support her, which is essentially texting and sometimes talking, which can, I don't mean to minimize that. It sounds really intense and like the level of communication is extremely high and very focused on her and not on you at all, which is another component. So yeah, I honestly have, I don't know. I'm not sure what I would suggest. I think that it's great that you have been so supportive and so present for her when she needs you. It sounds like I'm not a doctor. Let's clarify that real quick. But the fact that she is asking you things like, how do I address an envelope? How do I sign a document? It sounds like she might be having some like executive dysfunction along with the depression and the anxiety, which I have also experienced, and it is very no fun. And that she just needs that sort of reassurance and like help getting things done, even really simple things that seem like they should be absolutely no problem because she's done it a million times before. Everyone has done this a million times before. It's not hard. But sometimes your brain makes it hard because sometimes your brain is an asshole and it sounds like hers is being one. But yeah, I'm rambling because I don't know. There's just so much here to consider. There's
right
the kids. I feel so like I feel for those kids immensely. There's the fact that she is in counseling and on medication, which is wonderful. Like, I'm so glad that she is getting some level of, like, help. But then she's still drinking every day, which sounds, you know, contraindicated with the medication. And so, but there's nothing you can do about that, really. So, I don't know. What do you think? I'm sorry. I'm talking a lot.
Yeah. I think I'm with you on a lot of this. I think one thing that I do think is important is that, again, as long as you're sort of behaving with a baseline level of like kindness and respect, it is okay, I think, to feel privately frustrated or irritated with somebody else's behavior, even as you're aware that it's not necessarily something that's within a lot of their control.
I'd hope I didn't suggest that it wasn't okay to feel that way.
Yeah, or just that it's even okay to set limits before it's like, you know, my health is at stake. It's also just okay to set limits because you don't like something, even if somebody else is dealing with something that like you recognize is very difficult. And so I think, you know, if she is texting you throughout the day, like when you are at work, and you already know that she has a lot of contacts and colleagues to walk her through the process and that her father is being really well cared for. So, you know, there's not an emergency, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if she's having a lot of anxiety about addressing an envelope in one afternoon, as painful and difficult as it may be to know that your friend is suffering in that way, it also seems like you know that texting with her for the next 4 hours that she does know how
it's
to do it
help.
Is actually maybe not the most helpful thing you can do for her.
Yeah.
And that in those moments, it's actually really okay to say, I'm not available to talk about this with you. I encourage you to discuss it with, you know, X or Y point person. I love you. Let's talk later.
Yeah.
And to set that limit. And if she follows that up with a lot of intense text messages, it's really hard, I think, sometimes with a friend who's dealing with something like this to figure, like, am I being cold or harsh if I don't respond to somebody else's emotional levels? And I think, you know, you as somebody who knows her pretty well will be a better judge of, like, when is a genuine emergency and when is it okay for me to say, like, I encourage you to talk to somebody else about this. I can't be available for this right now. But to also, like, set a time for either later in the day or later in the week for you two to connect. And it's also okay for you to say things like, hey, I'd love to catch up maybe like on a weekly basis, but I'm not going to be available to answer a lot of logistical questions. Okay for you to say too. And it's also okay for you to say occasionally like, hey, we've been talking about this for a while. I'd really like to talk to you about how my life is going. Again, I know that a lot of this feels like big, and I'm not suggesting you do it all on one day where you're just like, and I'm not going to answer these questions anymore. And now we're going to talk about my stuff. And I just want you to get over all this. Like,
That's not recommended.
Right. And I think you're aware this is probably not going to go away anytime soon. She's receiving, you know, help both like medically and therapeutically. And it's, you know, helping some, but it's not like quote unquote fixing the problem. And she's also doing some self-medicating on alcohol that sounds like it's kind of contraindicating the medication that she's taking. So these are just, I think, strategies that are going to help you figure out what aspects of your relationship you can be there for while this is going on, and just not knowing when is this going to change? Will it change? Will things ever return to the previous status quo, or will there just be a new way of interacting with your friend from now on? Because we just don't know that, right?
Yeah. I also feel like that it's very possible that your friend just maybe doesn't even realize what she's doing. Particularly in the ignoring or not responding when you're talking about yourself. I say that as someone who has been that person and not realized that I have done that. If I get like really in my head, and it's helpful for me personally when my friends say, hey, let's talk about this other thing that like is important to me, which makes me sound like a really terrible friend. I promise I'm not. But so I don't know. I think that, yeah, I agree with everything you just said. And I think it could be worthwhile to even just point out gently, like, hey, so, like, explicitly, like, we haven't talked about, like, my stuff lately. Can I share something that's really exciting or, like, something that I, you know, think you would be interested in or whatever? Just to sort of get that, like, that component of the relationship back into the foreground a little bit, especially with mental health stuff. It's so easy for those little, seemingly little, like, day-to-day things to get lost, like the good stuff. And I don't know. I think that that could be really helpful. Again, I mean, I don't know your friend, but that could be something.
Yeah. And I think to balance the compassion that you feel for your friend with appropriate limits. Because I feel like right now what you're setting yourself up for is eventual ghosting or blowing up at her. Neither of which are going to be helpful, right? Where in your mind, you confuse compassion with doing everything your friend wants on her terms, on her timeline. And then eventually when that stops working.
Right. Which is what I meant with like, self-care. Like you have to make sure that you are also taken care of in the ways that you need, because, you know, it's the whole airplane oxygen mask thing, right? Like you can't help if you're drowning as well.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's not necessarily helpful to do all of those things. So I think instead of doing that, to say things like, I cannot give you an immediate response on this. And this is not an emergency. I mean, maybe don't say this is not an emergency. That may not be helpful. But just go with like, I can't talk about this with you right now. I'm at work. And that might feel like, oh, how could I possibly say that? She might get really upset. And she might. And she also might not. Like, it also might not be the emergency that you think it's going to be if you say, like, this is actually not an emergency. And then really do that. Really don't check your phone. Really get back to work. Because you know she does have other resources in her life. And she will be able to turn to them if you are not available to text her about these things at, like, 3 p.m.
And I also think that there's a difference, too, and this is, you know, just probably important for the letter writer to keep in mind to feel better about like these boundaries, is there's a difference between invalidating your friend's feelings and your friend's anxiety and your friend's like state and saying, I can't do that. Like there's a difference between saying you're being unreasonable and I just can't. Like, those are two separate things. And I think that's why I got a little hung up on the irritating word. Like, that reads to me like your feelings are invalid, which I know is not what the letter writer is saying at all. Like, they're clearly yes. very, very loving and compassionate and caring. But yeah, so like that's sort of just a way to sort of approach how you frame your responses, to just make it as neutral, like value neutral as possible.
Right. Yeah, because you're not like I don't want you to say to her like this is dumb and not a real emergency and you need to just like calm down about it, because that's not helpful. And, you know, a super not cool thing to say to somebody who's dealing with like rampant depression and anxiety. But it is OK for you to say, you know, I can't help you with this right now. You know, I love you. We'll talk later. But you need to call your doctor or your therapist or somebody else. Because one of those is saying like, this is not a real problem and you shouldn't feel this way. And the other one is just truthfully acknowledging your own limits without making any sort of judgment call about whether or not your friend is right to feel the way that she feels.
Yep. That's, I think, the key point there.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, I'm sure your friend is not like, man, I really get a lot out of stressing out about these things. Like, I don't think that she's doing this because like she doesn't want to have these emergencies, I think, any more than you do.
Yeah. And I can almost guarantee you that she does not want to negatively affect you or your life in any way. And probably, I mean, this is pure speculation, 1,000,000%. But I would wager there's a strong chance that she feels terrible every time she has to ask you something. Like, nobody likes being that person. Like, nobody wants to be that friend who, like, constantly needs help and constantly needs validation and needs, like, assistance. But it's also totally legitimate, like we've said, to recognize that you can't always be that person. Someone else needs to be that person sometimes too.
Yeah. And it's hard, right? Like, you know, you're also aware that there's ways in which she's like not able to parent the way that she used to right now, and that it's really hard on her husband, and that there's some concern about her drinking. And like, those are all pretty big things too. And I think you might be able to devote a little bit more time or energy to figuring out whether or not you can do anything helpful there when you're not dealing with the sort of like daily triage of answering all these text messages. And again, like, I know she's your best friend of many, many years. Those are also not necessarily problems that you have to fix for her. But like, of course, for a very dear friend you've known for decades, of course it's going to trouble you when you realize that this is affecting her ability to parent. Like, that's just a given.
That's just, yeah, it's just so difficult all around. Like, it's difficult to be the person watching this happen without any real, like, feeling like you don't have any real way to help. And it's difficult to be that person who's, like, you know, not doing well and wants to be doing better. And, yeah, it's just, yeah, nobody's having fun. But I fully believe that you both can, you can do this. Like, you can love that person, you can love your friend, and you can take care of yourself at the same time. I think that those are completely compatible things, even in a difficult situation like this.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So I know we've already gone a little bit over, but I really want to play this voicemail.
Okay, let's do it.
Dear Prudence, a few months ago, I was walking out of a bar hand in hand with my boyfriend. As we were headed towards our lift, we passed a couple of guys on the street walking in the opposite direction, and one of them sort of stopped my boyfriend. He kind of held his hand up to his chest and said, "Dude, you're handsome. What are you doing with her?" And it stung really hard. I got in the lift and kind of started awkwardly crying along with the driver because my boyfriend said he wanted to go back and quote-unquote talk to the guy. He eventually came back to my relief because the lift driver obviously wanted to go, saying that he was unable to find him in the crowd. He could tell how upset I was, and he tried everything to reassure me, but it still really hurt. So, like I said, it's been a few months now, and this incident is still something that I think about. it's not like it's on my mind all the time, but as soon as I start to feel insecure, it's a memory that takes over in a way that I really don't want it to. I've always felt insecure about my looks, and at times have agreed with this random stranger and kind of felt like my boyfriend might be more attractive than me, but of course never thought that was a reason he shouldn't be with me. But either way, I took it as kind of objective evidence, just an outsider's perspective looking in, and that really hurt. And what I hate about all of this most is that despite my knowing better, I'm still letting it get to me. I feel like I've been really diligent about the ways that I self-reflect, as a feminist, always striving to avoid, reducing myself to my physical qualities, despite constant cues that I should do just that. So I also know that being hurt by this gives his words power, and I really don't like that. I know he was just a douchey guy at a bar. I know that my boyfriend doesn't see me as less than. So why can't I let it go?
So this is like the nightmare, right?
Oh, my God.
Like, that you're literally just going down the street and a stranger says something to you that you've often worried privately about yourself. And you're just like,
yep.
Okay, great.
Oh, again, another person I want to just give a giant hug to. Like,
yeah, there is a guy not far from this studio who hangs out a lot outside of some of the coffee shops in Berkeley near campus. And he often likes to say stuff to strangers as they pass by.
Oh, my God.
And he sometimes likes to say stuff to me. And sometimes he doesn't. Like, it's just infrequently enough that, like, my heart rate, like, triples every time I walk past him. And I'm just always like, play it cool. Play it super cool. And one of the first times that I ever wore men's shoes, I had been shopping with a friend of mine in the city, and I found this really, like, great pair of Oxfords that I liked a lot, and they were, like, a tiny bit too big. But not noticeably. It wasn't, like, clown shoes. I wasn't, like, slipping around in them. They were just a tiny bit too big. And I was like, whatever, I'll get little, like, insoles or whatever, like, to make them
fit
better.
Yeah, like inserts or something?
Yeah, and I have since bought better-fitting shoes. But I, like, really liked them, and then I was, like, walking. And I, like, he hadn't said anything to me the last couple of times I'd seen him, so I was feeling kind of relaxed, like, maybe he's cool now. And as I walked past him to record this show, this was, like, a year and a bit ago, he, like, very quietly whispered as I walked past, like, you know those shoes are too big for you.
Oh, my God.
I was just like, oh, my God. And he whispered it, which is such a power move. And I was just like,
yes.
Oh, he gets it better than, like, he knows what those shoes represent. He knows mm-hmm. this is new for me. He knows that I don't have years of experience buying this kind of shoes, and he knows I'm a fraud.
No. Like, I don't condone violence of any kind, really, but, like, if I lived in Berkeley, I could accidentally, you know, hit some toes. That's all I'm saying.
No, like, no, no.
Happen.
Look, this man is out here speaking wicked truth to me. And, you know, obviously he and I are going to play some sort of, you know, important thematic role in one another's lives before the final conflagration comes down on all of us. And I can't, you know, I can't preemptively push him off of the play, you know?
I have
we
missed
need him.
You.
Yeah. So this is, again, like, just to reassure you, letter writer, this is horrible. Like, the fact that you are still thinking about this a couple of months on is incredibly understandable to me.
Yes.
Like, I still think about this guy and the shoes, and that was well over a year ago. In part because I think we tend to assume that the worst things about us that anyone says are the truest, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, everyone else I can't really trust because they care about me and they're probably sugarcoating things. But if somebody I don't know or who doesn't wish me well says something designed to hurt me, it can't be for any reasons about, like, where they're coming from or a desire to hurt me. It's got to just be they're so committed to truth that they had to say this. Whereas I'm willing to bet, you know, caller, if you were walking down the street and this same guy, like, put a hand in your boyfriend's chest and said something about the Electoral College or, like, where to find the best fish in your town, you wouldn't necessarily be like, ah, the voice of wisdom. Like, you would not, or like, here's how you should talk to your parents. Like, you would maybe listen to him, but you wouldn't necessarily think like, oh, this guy's got it. This guy knows what's up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, the caller even specifically said something about like objectivity. Like, this is somebody objective looking in from the outside with a clear view of the situation. And like, that's not how that works. And I know you know that that's not how that works, but that voice in your head saying that, oh no, this is 1,000,000% true. Like, the truth, the only truth is, it's so hard. Like, it's so hard to not listen to it, to not let it play over and over again. Like, Lord knows. I mean, I have essentially made a career so far on writing about all the horrible things that people have said and that I think about myself and like working through that. Like, every one of my essays just about is me processing that, particularly in terms of like my looks and the way people view my body and the way I view my body in response. So I don't think there's anything like wrong or unfeminist about feeling that way, about just like having those feelings. They suck and I hate it for you and I don't want you to have them, but I also don't want you to be too hard on yourself for having them. Like, that doesn't make you a bad person or a bad feminist or like you're giving some guy power. Like, it's just, it's one of those things. Like, feel your feelings is my unhelpful advice.
Yeah. And just in those moments when you're tempted to think like, this guy held the truth, everyone else is trying to be nice to me, but this guy was the one person who was really willing to be honest. Mm-hmm. Just think like, this guy was stumbling down the street. He threw his hand up in a stranger's chest and said, hey, dude, you're handsome. What are you doing with her? Mm-hmm. Like, is that objective behavior? Is that the act of a bold truth teller? Do you know what I mean? Like, this guy's not like Samuel Pepys walking out of a coffee shop having just learned of the latest news from Vienna, you know, straightening his quizzing glass and striding forth into the Enlightenment or whatever. Like, this is the behavior of a cruel and drunken boor who's attempting to stir shit and start a fight. Who's randomly accosting strangers. Like, nothing about this guy's behavior suggests to me that it was born out of calm and reasoned objectivity.
The furthest thing from that.
Like, patently and on its face, misogynist. The fact that he was addressing your boyfriend about your appearance, again, like, it just makes it really clear, like, where was he coming from? He wanted to hurt a woman. And he wanted to make it clear that he did not think you were worth addressing. He wanted to address you through the man you were with. Like, this dude's not objective. He's very aware that, like, a really easy sexist way to take a shot at a woman is to talk about and to denigrate her looks. And by the way, too, you don't say that this guy was like a young Apollo. Not that that would have made it okay. But again, it's just like another point in the category of like, maybe he is not like Paris judging the three goddesses on who will get the golden apple of discord. Do you know what I mean? Like, he might not be the best judge of all of which is besides the point, right? Like, whether or not he was super babely or not at all comely is not the point. I hope you can let go of this mental image that you have in your mind, which must be the gap between our respective attractivenesses must be so profound that a mere stranger walking down the street was so struck by it that he was moved to speech, rather than a drunk, sexist, misogynist asshole wanted to hurt a woman and decided to hurt me. Yep. Because that's what happened.
And probably for no other reason than the fact that you were there. Like, it probably would have just been, I mean, I know it would have just been whoever was nearest when that impulse struck was going to be the target.
Yeah, again, I think there's that fear of like, man, if he had walked past a couple that he thought were really appropriately matched, he would have stopped them and said, hey, good job, you're both the same level of attractive. No, this guy's not an objective truth teller. He's a sexist asshole, and he wanted to hurt a woman, and he would have found something to say that was hurtful and cruel in that moment, regardless of who was walking past him.
But I do just also want to like recognize again that I feel like the caller like knows that, but it's just so different. I mean, not that it's not worth repeating emphatically from us as well, because it helps to hear it from somebody else as well. But I think the the fact that it's still hurtful and that it was hurtful in the moment and that it is now, even though you know, like on an intellectual level, that this is not something, like all the things that we've been saying, even though you know that, it's really hard to also feel it and believe it. And that's okay, I think. Like, I think that this shit takes a lot to work through. Like, it takes a lifetime of unlearning and of, like, learning something else in its place. And that's not going to happen overnight, and that's okay. And it sucks, again. And I hope it helps to hear it from us, like, that your impulse about him not being, you know, super reliable as a narrator is a good one. But that it's also okay to not fully believe it yet.
Yep. And to just say, don't beat yourself up for the fact that this periodically comes up. Like, don't be hard on yourself for having feelings. Just in those moments when you remember it or you think about it again, just kind of say to yourself as neutrally as possible, I'm feeling sad because a stranger hurt my feelings. And that's okay. And let that moment ride itself out. Like, just let yourself feel it all the way through. Don't try to say, I should be tougher than this. I should be over this by now. Just let yourself feel the feeling. Eventually, it will burn itself out. You know, eventually there is a limit to how sad or guilty or self-loathing you can feel. And it will, you know, it will finish. The feeling will be done. And you will have seen it, you know, start and peak and exit. And you will realize afterwards, like, oh, I'm still here. That feeling came and eventually went away. And I was here this whole time. And I can't rush it off the premises by trying to shoo it away. And then when it does come up, I'll just remind myself, I'm feeling really sad because somebody really was trying to hurt my feelings. And it's awful to think that a stranger walking down the street would want to hurt me like that. But again, to just remember, like, I don't think you would take that guy's opinion if he, like, walked down and immediately was like, invest in hog futures. You wouldn't be like, thank you, objective stranger. Like, he's just not somebody who I think has displayed good judgment or good instincts or good people skills. I don't think you need to ascribe to him expertise.
Yeah, no. And I also think it's probably, like, if he were somebody who saw a, like, picture of you online and said this, like, I feel like you probably wouldn't remember it as clearly because it didn't happen in person. Like, there's that physicality, I think, adds to the issue, like, adds to the hurt.
The aggressiveness of that cruelty.
Like, the aggressiveness, yeah. And, like, the invasion and the violation of, like, being in a physical space with that person when they do this and when they say this versus, like, if he were just some guy on the internet, like, anonymously adding you on Twitter, like, you wouldn't care. Like, he probably would be like, okay, cool, muted or blocked, whatever, I'm done. So I don't know if that helps to consider that in a different context, how it would have affected you or not. But there's that as well. I think that it's important to remember that, like, yeah, a physical space is going to have a different response from you than maybe it would elsewhere.
And that he said it to your boyfriend.
I know. Like, I can't get over that.
That's horrible. And the implication there is that, like, your looks are a reflection on him, that your boyfriend deserves a certain level of attractiveness that is somehow universally agreed upon and that he has merited by virtue of his own appearance, and that he needs to do something about it. I mean, that's horrible. Everything about this is just, like...
It's just the worst.
Just awful. Yeah.
Like, again, not super into, like, violence, but I do own and drive a 300-pound wheelchair every day. So, like, I'm inclined to use it creatively if I were to ever meet this guy.
I cannot condone this behavior.
I know.
But I certainly can wish that this dude would someday wake up and realize what he did with the full weight of the human conscience. And then just
you're
really,
a better
like,
person than I.
That. That's not true.
I feel like what we're learning here is that you should not have invited me onto this show.
You're doing fabulous. This guy, I get that this one's going to sting. This is just going to be something that you can't pull this one out of where it's embedded in your mind. Don't feel bad that this is staying with you. This would stay with me too. But I don't think that this guy was just so objectively moved by your appearance that he had to say what he said. I think he was cruel and drunk and boorish and sexist and wanted to hurt you and just went for, like, what, you know, what's the easiest way to hurt a woman in a, like, sexist, misogynist society is go for her appearance. Like, it was not creative or nuanced or based on like observation. Like it's just the thing sexists go for. And I'm glad, by the way, that your boyfriend like tried to find the guy, checked in on you, that his response was not just like, oh, what are you going to do? Like, I'm really glad that he was neither overreacting and like trying to throw the guy into a river, nor underreacting and being like, don't worry about it, it's fine. Like, I'm glad that he was there for you. And I'm glad that you're kind of thinking about how you can be kinder to yourself in the aftermath of this.
Agreed.
And I just hope he gets a paper cut on the webbing in between all of his fingers every day for the rest of his life.
See, we're on the same level again now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like this.
There's that violent impulse. Well, Kayla, thank you so much for coming on this show.
Thank you for finding me on. It was so much fun.
Did you learn anything? Did you reach any sudden epiphanies? Do you think that anything is going to change about your life?
I mean, I definitely learned some new information about the 80s economic situation.
Right.
So that was cool. And okay, to be real though, like what you said about feeling like we have to suffer in order to deserve whatever, like I was not kidding when I said that really hit me really, really hard and is something that I've been dealing with a lot lately personally. So like, thank you for saying that because it did affect me. So there's that.
I hope it affects you in a way that is eventually helpful.
Oh, it was extremely helpful. I'm sure.
Good. Good. Thanks, Kayla. Get out of here. Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Max Jacobs. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/dearprudence to subscribe. And remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute, tops. Thanks for listening.